This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
And I'd like to just start us off by thinking about some connections between Huangrei's I Ching performance here at Slot and the history of translating the I Ching in Europe. For me, Huangrei's piece, which he began performing in the 1980s, combines very powerfully two components that have for centuries made China a source of fascination and contradiction for the West. So on the one hand, it's exemplary virtue or morality, and on the other hand, it's exemplary commerce or manufacturing. And my own book, Performing China, studies how ideas about Chinese morality were being imported into England in tandem with radically new luxury commodities like tea, silk, and porcelain between 1660 and 1760, which, as I'm sure you all know, was a period of remarkable mercantile expansion for England. And I'm interested in this book in looking at how English ideas of virtue that ranged from heroism to piety to patriotism were being shaped and then reshaped by encounters with the East and with England's growing dependency on its East India trade. So I ask how Chinese characters, historical events, aesthetic forms were being staged for British audiences, both in the theater, in lavish plays like Arthur Murphy's The Orphan of China, but also through social performances of cultural and gender impersonations. For example, the French imposter George Psamenazar, who for a number of years actually successfully pretended to be a native of Formosa in London in the 1700s. This English fascination with exemplars of Eastern pagan virtue, such as Confucius, the philosopher prince, made China a kind of moral spectacle during this period. And I argue that this sense of a spectacle of Chineseness continues to be seen today in different forms, whether in something like the televised Beijing Summer Olympic ceremonies of 2008, or in the conspicuous mass production and consumption of commodities, indeed commodities like imported umbrellas. What struck me most about Huangrei's performance last month outside Slot across the street was how he managed to transform a very prosaic commodity, an umbrella, into an instrument for staging public encounters between individuals and across cultures, and how this, in practice, I think, actually brought together again, once again, virtue and commerce through his translation of classical Chinese wisdom into a street spectacle and into something that, for me, was unexpectedly mystical. So for those of you who weren't there, Huangrei inscribed onto 64 of these black and white umbrellas the hexagram symbols and Chinese characters of the I Ching, or the Book of Changes, an ancient divinational text from the early Zhou period of 1150 BC. He asked each volunteer participant to stand with him for 64 seconds under their umbrella, which was numbered 1 out of 64, and then to stay in the vicinity for 64 minutes, the duration of the piece, after which they could take away the umbrella as a memento that would continue to work its magic in their everyday life. And so in the spirit of this public presence, I've brought Exhibit A, umbrella number 10 of the I Ching that I took home with me that night. I have to admit that my own experience of the performance was initially one of doubts. Doubts both small and large, ranging from, could I in fact hold up an umbrella for 64 minutes for that amount of time as it got darker and colder outside, to could we actually get 64 people to participate in this, and if we couldn't, how would the piece be completed? Huang had earlier told me that Chinese students in China who'd experienced his performance told him that they'd finally understood the enigmatic geometry and cosmological order of the I Ching, a classical text they'd always studied in school after this kind of interaction with him on the streets. But for a Philadelphia Penn audience that would not be familiar with the I Ching, I wondered whether Huang, an established avant-garde artist known in China for his political activism, whether or not this would simply not translate in this context. Would he become an object of mockery, a foreign-looking jester outfitted in a black and white costume that looks rather comical? And you can see, for some of you, the piece staged elsewhere. This costume that looks very unsubtle, very retrograde, and rather comical. But for me, at least, the unexpected did happen as he stood there, fixed in this yin-yang circle he'd taped to the concrete. One of my undergrad students commented to me, he's like a shaman. And one actually did get a sense, oddly enough, of absolute privacy standing under the cover of this umbrella, however permeable, right, with him for 64 seconds, often in awkward silence, right? So for some people, he usually didn't start talking to you. So you could talk to him, or you might just stand there not really knowing what you were doing together. And at the same time, there was this sense that a temporary community was being created from the gathering of 64 bodies of people who agreed to stay either out of curiosity or determination to take home this free prize, right? And on a personal note, I have to say that, you know, I found myself wondering how was it that the umbrella I was given, number 10 out of the I Ching, which translates into the principle of li, or treading, or carrying out a plan step by step in accordance with good conduct and perseverance, how did this uncannily seem to resonate with the fact that I'd gotten tenure after 6 years at Penn, or that it seemed to uncannily match my Western zodiac sign of the Capricorn, right? So, you know, I was standing there wondering, you know, is this magic that's happening on the corner of 40th and Walnut in front of the rave movie theater, right? And so I was thinking that, you know, this process that Huang enacts with playing with the I Ching's principles of harmony, simplicity, transformation, persistence, is a process that also has to do with the politics not only of translation, but of untranslatability. So I'm hoping, since we're surrounded by some of his performance work, we can talk a little bit about how Huang's radical politics translate and do not translate across linguistic and cultural barriers. That is, how does he appropriate the mysticism of the I Ching, as so many before him, from Leibniz to John Cage, who's in the room with us here, to Carl Jung, have done. And so, you know, this handout that you have in front of you is just so that you can see some of the European transcriptions of the I Ching and the Taoist concept of yin and yang in the 17th and 18th centuries, when Enlightenment philosophers and Jesuit missionaries idealized Chinese and Chinese language as a universal, primitive, biblical language. Leibniz, in particular, found in the I Ching what he considered to be a pure form of Christianity and a form of mathematical knowledge thought to govern the universe that was expressed in the lines that you see here that make up the hexagrams, where the solid horizontal lines, the yang, became the ones, and the broken lines, the yin, became the zeros of the binary numerical system that Leibniz invented. And so this bottom excerpt here is actually taken from his Explication de l'arithmétique binaire of 1703, where you can see his translations of the horizontal lines into numbers and then into Roman numerals. And indeed, this binary arithmetic of zeros and ones undergirds the basis of modern computing today. So if the I Ching became this mathematical aesthetic Christian form for Enlightenment philosophers, what's political about the I Ching? Two things. To begin with, the Book of Changes in China offered advice for subjects and magistrates to negotiate the tyranny of the king during the Zhou dynasty. And even in the 17th century Europe, those like Leibniz or the Jesuit Bouvet turned to this hermetic tradition, this mystical tradition of the I Ching, in an attempt to try to synthesize Chinese and Christian thought. But their figurism was also too radical for its time because it disrupted existing Christian biblical timelines, and it actually turned the Jesuits against the missionaries because the I Ching was not Confucian. It was not literary enough. It was not a text to be studied by the Chinese literati or elite. In fact, it tended to be a tool of street fortune tellers instead. So how then does the political lose its politics when it moves from China into the US? And conversely, how is the mystical political, even across borders? Huang's work, some of you may know, comes out of a radical post-cultural revolution moment of artists that were protesting government censorship. So he was 27 years old in 1979 when he co-founded the Xingxing group, or the Stars group, along with other artist dissidents like Ai Weiwei, who continues to face state censorship today for his internet activism and his arrest in April of 2011. And I just want to conclude by quoting from Salman Rushdie's writing about Ai Weiwei, which might help us think through Huang Rei's practice as well. Rushdie writes, Mr. Ai's work is often not polemical. It tends toward, instead, the mysterious. But his immense prominence as an artist has allowed him to take up human rights cases and to draw attention to China's often inadequate responses to disasters like the Sichuan earthquake in 2008. The Enlightenment fascination with translating the I Ching and of synthesizing Eastern and Western thought was premised on imagining that Chinese language was a perfect one-to-one relationship between word and thing, so that each character was thought to equal one word. But I think what Huang Rei and Go Su Lian show us through their performances of the mysteries of translation is that this type of idealized and over-idealized correspondence can actually be mobilized into public interaction and into social protest through their commitment to the body and to bodily public presence that's disruptive in large and small ways, as you're seeing here on the screen. Thanks.
All of us have written about China, but from what I think are quite different and unexpected perspectives. China is a topic of great concern to everybody, but for the most part, it's still considered, right, within the aegis of area studies. And, you know, as a concept, and I think this is something that you see so strongly in both Qi Ming and Homei's works. So these are their two books. Their work really breaks China out of this mold of area studies to think about how China travels around as a concept, how China mediates, right? China's not just represented, but China really mediates a whole set of relations in the West. And one of the things that I really want to talk about tonight is the way in which China mediates an entire modern discourse of human rights, but a much longer discourse of the human in global modernity. So what I'm going to do, in order to kind of get to that, I'm going to first offer a few comments on Go Su Lian's work, and then I'm going to try to situate her politically within the space of contemporary China, but I also then want to broaden that out to get to this problem of contemporary problem of human rights, but this longer problem of the human. So how many of you actually have had a chance to look through the installation, like her performance pieces, or did any of you actually see the performance or the signs? No? All right, so let me, I'll tell you a little bit about her and then I'll try to walk us through the work. So Kosulam was born in 1977, so she's young. She's in her mid-30s in Xiamen, China, and then later she immigrated to Hong Kong where she grew up. She holds an MPhil in sociology from Hong Kong University. So, you know, she's incredibly smart and very political. She worked for a series of NGOs in China until 2007 when she quit and then went to Paris to study art and got a graduate degree in art there in 2009. And she largely works in performance. Some installations and cross-media projects. She also works in several languages. So you can see with the signs, she is constantly in the mode of translation that Qiming was talking about. And she works largely in Chinese and English, but also in French. And with the signs, you see that what she does is she kind of reinvents common words and slogans. That's at the heart of her process. They're clever. They're humorous, they're puns, and they're very, very political. So in a sense, she combines the political with the everyday and with the aesthetics, right? All of that is bundled up and closely intertwined in her oeuvre. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the Harmonious Signs Project. So the signs that you saw installed all over the campus, and I have a few of the more pictures in my slideshow. These are all part of what she calls the Harmonious Signs Project. And, you know, signs and mistranslated signs are around us all over. And here's one that is my favorite in Philadelphia. When I take the Chinatown bus from New Century, there's a sign in the ticket window, right, not the New Century, but underneath it, we are not responsible for any belonging. Which, you know, is hilarious, right? Because it's an entire public, right, transportation system that's set up by basically illegal immigrants. And, you know, the mistake of, you know, belonging versus belongings really, you know, gets us into a whole discourse, right, of illegal immigration, of social, you know, national belonging, of citizenship, etc. And, you know, so there's a part of it, right, that is really humorous, but there's a part of it that's actually deadly political. And you could almost say that, you know, there is a political unconscious around these kind of political issues that creeps in to the signs. And so there is also a way, I think, where in working in English and Chinese, it may seem like it's just a kind of mistranslation, mm-hmm. right? But she also works in images, so it's always triangulated. But to the extent that the two areas, right, of global influence today are Chinese and English, right, there's also, I think, a whole discourse of global English and global Chinese, right, and this kind of encounter between not just different societies, but different, you know, world powers on the global stage today. The signs also, as she says, encode a kind of political and social mores of a particular society. Right? They seem, like everyday street signs, they seem to be the most mundane of everyday objects, but yet it tells the viewer a lot about the ways in which that particular culture functions, what you can and cannot do, what you should and should not do. And so here I actually just want to play for you a little bit of her interview here at Slot on that Friday. I think it was that Friday during her performance when she talked about the installation signs. And it'll give you a sense of where she's coming from. And you know, she's coming from all of these different directions. So after I play that, then I'm going to really kind of focus on human rights and the human, but I don't want to, you know, kind of close down the different ways in which one can interpret her signs.
I'm very happy while I was installing the signs. A lot of people, you know, came and make comments and also asked about what are you doing? What's the purpose of the sign? Oh, art installation. How do you define what you're doing? I say, why do you need a definition? Or there are some other comments people are asking. What is this? Is this from North America? Are you commenting about North a career, not America. Is this about North Korea? What are these signs about? I say, well, it's about everywhere. And it could be about America as well. He said, oh, really? And then another lady, as I was installing caution democracy sign, she said, I thought democracy is for everyone. I say, yes. And she said, but why are you installing it in front of someone else's building? It should be for everyone. I say, okay. And I also have Chinese students come up and say, can I ask you why these signs are in Chinese? I think one of the initial invitations come from Aaron, whose phone is ringing, and also Joshua. And I think I was a little bit not exactly sure of what the nature of the project is, but I think that's good because they leave it very open. They say we have this space for you, but you're very free to do whatever you want to do.
Sense of the own way in which she explains her projects. What's so fascinating about these signs is that they're not. Some of them are direct translations, and some of them absolutely are not. So, I mean, even the title for this show, China, right, is this pun about, Thai is like to kind of take apart, to disassemble. And if you turn around and look at that, you can see, there's this whole theme, right, of taking things apart. And so this sign, right, corruption in progress, in English is actually mistranslated in Chinese. It's kind of indexed to the graphic, which is please be quiet, please keep quiet. And the very idea of harmonious signs, right, these are not harmonious signs, but yet they're also the kinds of signs that you need in order to keep society harmonious, right? And I think the key thing for me around harmonious society is that it's also indexing a whole discourse of civic responsibility and human rights, or China's version of human rights, which comes out in the phrase Huxie Shihui, which is the harmonious society. So if you go into China, to mainland China, and you saw this especially during the Beijing Olympics, just lots and lots of signs like this saying the harmonious society, Huxie Shihui, which is, as I said, really a kind of competing discourse. Like, people always say China is the antithesis of human rights. It does not extol human rights in the way that we think about a legacy of liberal humanism and individual rights. But there's certainly an entire tradition of virtue and morality and the way in which society is supposed to function. And a contemporary example of that is precisely the harmonious society, which I think she's completely playing off on in the harmonious sign show. I wanted to talk a little bit about her installations. I think they're completely brilliant. The one that I'm going to focus on is in the corner, and it's called Memory of Air. And it's a street performance that deals with the politics of history and memory and, of course, forgetting. She stands on a street. It looks like it's Tung Lo Wan in Hong Kong, which is a very, very busy commercial district. And she's blindfolded, and she writes in the air, Liu Si, it looks like 6-4, right, in the air, which is June 4th, which is Tiananmen. And she repeats this again and again and again amongst a bustling marketplace. And when I saw this, it really struck me that there is, on one level, a movement toward the problem of history as a repetition compulsion, right? That you have like one disaster after another, right, which she's kind of tracing out. But in its very tracing out, right, it indexes a desire to remember, which is very much constrained, right, by the problem of history and the problem of politics. There's also a kind of ephemeral nature, right, to her actions and in all of her videos, right? These are site-specific performance pieces that almost disappear in their very appearance. So you can see, along with that video, there's a video called Waiting for Time, which is about the dismantling of the Star Ferry, which for many, many decades was a kind of symbol, right, of Hong Kong. It connected, before the tunnels were built, the Hong Kong Island with the Kowloon side. And it really reminded me of this kind of fact, right, which is not just about China, but really about Hong Kong, that Benjamin talks about. In the convulsions of the commodity economy, we recognize the monuments of the bourgeoisie as ruins even before they have crumbled, right? And I think that like more than any, when I read that Benjamin line, I just think immediately this is Hong Kong and the constant move to build and rebuild to almost tear down, right, mm-hmm. as you're erecting these new buildings. And the third thing that I really was thinking about is how in the recording, right, of these ephemeral performances, so you have the repetition compulsion, this desire to remember, you have the repetition compulsion of atrocity after atrocity, but in their recording, right, and in their the ability to kind of repeat them on screen, for that to travel, you also have, right, a will to history that emerges in her work. And it's that ritual, right, writing 6-4 over and over again, like the 64 minutes, right? It's that repetition, it's that it's the way that that repetition bleeds into a form of ritual that makes me go back to this very idea of the harmonious society and the way in which political protest in China is not about, let's say, the liberal individual who's a subject of rights staring down the authoritarian state, but in fact, it's about a set of rights, R-I-T-E-S, not R-I-G-H-T-S, right? And one of the puns that I would offer in terms of really thinking about the cleaving of Western modes of political protest from Chinese modes of political protest is completely along these lines of rights, R-I-T-E-S, and rights, R-I-G-H-T-S. And here I would just, you know, point you to the social text issue that I've co-edited with Tamara Scola and Shuang Shen. Gloria Davies, who is an intellectual historian based at the University of Melbourne, she has an incredible, incredible essay on Tiananmen and the image of the tank man versus the image of the kneeling students. So the one street scene that's worth remembering, this is Michael Dutton's point, in contemporary China is the one on the left. That's the image that galvanized the world. And that's the image that's precisely, you know, about the lone individual subject of rights staring down the authoritarian state. Paradoxically, though that image had, you know, kind of an instant global circulation and inflamed the global imagination around China and Chinese human rights abuses, the image on the right, which was about the three students who were part of the democracy movement, that was taken on April 22nd, 1989, where these three students brought a 7-point petition to the Great Hall of the People during the memorial service for Hu Yaobang, who was the progressive and popular former party leader. His death, actually, was what catalyzed the protest movements. So these three students were ignored by the officials, and then they were later summarily arrested and thrown into jail. It was this image that inflamed the imagination of the Chinese public, right? So when the Chinese public sees that, they don't really get inflamed. When they see this on the right-hand side, it just indexes an entire and history, a millennial history, right, of the way of political protest is remonstrance. It's petitioning, right? You petition the emperor. It's not about this overt staring down, right, this Western opposition between the individual and the state. Rather, it's the posture of loyal Confucian subjects, virtuous, right, moral Confucian subjects who remonstrate the emperor, who remonstrate the Chinese Politburo. And it also, this image on the right also conjured up not just these ancient exemplars of moral moral virtue, but it also triggered memories of May 4th, 1919, and other patriotic movements which followed along this whole history of rites, right, and rituals, with China's kind of, you know, very bloody and tragic, right, entry into modernity. And, you know, here I want to kind of point out the way in which, you know, visual images which Rong Wei and Ko Xilan are really playing around with in these funny, as I said, clever, and very, very political ways, how this image of human rights and this problem of the human is so much played out on the level of a kind of global visionary, global visual imaginary. And here I'll just end, you know, with Qi Ming's gesture to the Olympics and Zhang Yimou's, right, organization of 15,000 synchronized bodies, what people called fascist calisthenics, during the opening ceremonies of the Olympics in, as you know, 2008. And Akbar Abbas, who has a visual dossier in the China and the Human issue, you know, he writes, he starts the whole dossier with Tiananmen and the Tank Man, and he ends it with this image of the 15,000 dancers who portray 5,000 years of Chinese history, you know, in a kind of unbroken, mass-mediated chain. And he says, the Tiananmen massacre has not been and cannot be excised from history, but its ghost can be exorcised in a spectacle. The exorcism begins by giving us something else to remember so that we can learn to forget. And here, I'm just going to end my comments. You know, it's really remembering, right, as something else. And I think, you know, you can also see that in the signs. It's translation as something else. Mm-hmm. And that something else is something that does not necessarily have to be regressive or progressive, but it is something that has to be read.
Thank you, David.
Clap louder.
All right. Thanks to both of you for such a stimulating start to the discussion. I have two questions that I pre-made for each of you, but I actually think maybe I'll start with a question, a more general question that leads directly from what David was just speaking about, and that wonderful essay in the Social Text issue by Akbar Abbas, in which he provides images of contemporary Chinese mm-hmm. art and performance artists and links it to the notion of China as spectacle for the West, which is something that many have written about, including Ray Chow, including those of us sitting at this table. So my question is really about China as spectacle. And it's about, in a way, is theater political? Is the theatrical political? And is politics theatrical? And I think initially we can say the answer to both questions is yes, but I wonder mm-hmm. how that's true in this case. And following from that, I'm very particularly interested in thinking about how that question gets worked through in, for example, contemporary Chinese film by a director like Zha Zhangke, whose films are associated with this new realist tradition of portraying the realities of Chinese modernization. At the same time, he is intensely interested in things that are already framed as performance or spectacle. So in many of his films, he's following performers or dance troupes or singers, characters who are already on display or already in the mode of display. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll start with that and see if either of you have thoughts about that.
I was thinking about this because just in thinking about this image, and actually Ai Weiwei was somebody who designed that bird's nest that's part of the Olympics too, but spectacle, when it's state-sponsored spectacle, and the mobilization of these thousands of bodies, right, versus what I was thinking about as spectacle at the scale of, say, Huang Rei's work or Ko Xiulan, which is very different. I don't even know now, you know, if we can call it spectacle when it's about drawing attention to the individual body, you know, that's not standing in front of a tank, right, that we get in that Tiananmen image, but that nonetheless is taking on the state in writing upon, you know, putting the writing upon one's body for Ko Xiulan, you know, putting the blindfold over herself, right, that there's something of the spectacular in the kind of performance art that I think seems in some ways outdated according to U.S. kind of histories of performance art, but that has this very radical edge when people like these artists are coming here from Beijing and when the stakes are so incredibly high for what they're doing and how they're protesting censorship by writing it upon themselves. So that's sort of one thought, right? If we can think through how this type of very personalized, intimate spectacle is speaking to state-sponsored spectacle, especially around questions of the body. And the other one is, David, you when you were talking about Ko Xiulan's harmonious signs, I was actually starting to think that maybe the way that these two artists are dealing with harmony in their Philadelphia installations are actually quite different, right? Because harmony becomes really insidious, you know, when she's taking on the idea of the harmonious society and putting it on these signs that seems very stealable, right? And indeed we're being stolen and innocuous in some ways. But I actually think that Huang Rei is trying to achieve harmony, yeah. right? I mean, he's taking the idea of harmony that's so fetishized with the I Ching, right? Mm-hmm. Where you've got the Complete Idiot's Guide to the I Ching available on Amazon, or, you know, so many books about living your Western life according to the I Ching, according to the harmony that is Eastern philosophy. But he's not actually overturning that, right? In a way, he's appropriating that and trying to do something else with it that might not be so harmonious. But, you know, I'm sort of wondering whether there's even how we're grouping them together, these two artists, because I think they're doing something very different with harmony and also with how they're engaging with bodily spectacle.
Well, and maybe ritual, which is a term that David brought up, could be used to, because in a way we're not talking about spectacle anymore. It's, you know, it's, we're not talking about state-sponsored fascist spectacle, and neither are we talking about capital-generated spectacle. It's no longer the Debordian sense of that term, at least I don't think, in these works.
Yeah.
I mean, I have three kind of very unconnected responses, you know. So I mean, I agree, Qiming, that I think they are doing something that's very different, and that Ko Xiulan is lodging a protest at what kind of incommensurabilities need to be overlooked in order to achieve a harmonious society, right? So that harmonious society is something that has to be produced. And it's produced precisely through these incommensurabilities, which come out, you know, literally on the signs. Whereas I think that there is a kind of intimacy, right, and related interrelatedness in the public sphere that that Huang Rei achieves and produces against all odds, right? So that's just kind of in response to what you were saying. And I would actually have a question for you, which is to say, the question of state-sponsored spectacle is not just something that is related to China, but the way in which China's produced as spectacle for other places in the world, such as, you know, Britain, in the period that you're studying. So, you know, in that respect, I would say there was a part that I was going to read, you know, from the intro, which is about how In the modern period, and I would date that all the way back, you know, to this moment that you explore in the book, which is the emergence of China mania, right? I would say that on the world stage, China is such a spectacle from that moment on, and that what you see in the kind of fall of China from, let's say, you know, more idealized notions of like Enlightenment philosophers, Spinoza, Leibniz, etc., in the West, to the 19th century with someone like Hegel, right? China falls into history, it falls into difference, it falls into the waiting room, right, of history, and it lags in development and modernity, it cannot participate, mm-hmm. you know, in a system of free trade, is the way in which then China's entire problem, right, of modernity comes to be symbolized, mm-hmm. right, as a spectacle of the body. Mm-hmm. And here I'm just thinking of like someone like Lu Xun, who is considered the great literary modernist of China. Mm-hmm. And in his stories, all you ever get is gory images of flayed bodies, bloody bodies, mm-hmm. dead infants, cannibalism, right? And really vivid kind of self-annihilating images mm-hmm. that are spectacular, right? And that mm-hmm. might actually be traced from there to all of these immolations now that are going on mm-hmm. around, let's say, Tibet. And it really raises this history, right, of China's spectacle in the question of the self-annihilating Chinese body and body politic. And Wang Xiaoming, who has an essay in this volume as well, says, you know, in Lu Xun's hands, the continuing crisis of China and the human comes to stand, this, like, you know, flayed human body comes to stand for the very problem, idea, and promise of modern Chinese revolution in the 20th century. And the more, like, I guess, the longer historical issue that I would bring up in relation to this is the way in which the ritual and the role of the artist or the intellectual just has a very different kind of status in the history of China, where it is the obligation. Like, believe it or not, public intellectuals have a huge kind of standing within the public sphere in China, and artists. This is why they're the ones that are being thrown in jail immediately, right, by the government, because what they say actually has effects. And there, I think it goes back to this whole idea of ritual, mm-hmm. display, theatricality, and the theater of the body is something that I think goes back to these ancient traditions about the way in which spiritual and moral principle Li, right, is related to the material substance of the body, Qi, right? And that Li and Qi are one of interaction rather than saying like a kind of Cartesian ghost in the machine model subjectivity that's in the West. So as far as the body and its display and theater is concerned, in the Orthodox Confucian view, it's not something that separates humans and constitutes their individuality in the way that we think about, you know, in the West, the body is a body to be defended. That's Ed Cohen's term. Something that the self-identical subject possesses as its own property, you know, to think about someone like Locke. But instead, the body really is a metaphor for intergenerational continuity between, right, the human and the body politic, or what actually connects, you know, one human to another mm-hmm. in Chinese civilization. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, the question that you're asking, Homei, is something that really has to be situated in a very different evolution of a philosophical tradition mm-hmm. about the body's status in relation to the body politic. Mm-hmm. Not like as separate, but as continuous.
Well, and so, in a way, I think that leads to one of the other questions I had, which is about Gloria Davies' essay and the idea, not just the body, but personhood as something that is conceived differently. And she has this wonderful sort of historical tracing of the concept of the human in China and the way that the human is not a given. It's something that one becomes or aspires to. And I wonder if we want to think about the category of the human, and so we've got China signs, human signs. To what extent do we want to talk about, do we want to think about, I mean, in a way, I think we're opposing the body to signs, and is there some way out of this, that sort of post-structuralist dilemma?
Can you explain that to me? We're opposing the body to signs?
Well, I guess, okay, let me try to explain this. The problem of positing China as spectacle and trying to think through the ways in which China appears as spectacle It means that we lose that possibility of thinking about, the human Chinese person as such.
Uh-huh.
And do we want to lose that materialism?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know,
okay.
It's,
I get what you're saying.
But in a way, maybe that's too abstract a question. Because I also wanted to ask you about reparation, which is a project that you're working on now. And you brought up the term ritual. You brought up the term repetition and repetition compulsion. You brought up the term petition. And so I'm wondering, is performance reparative? Is reparation a performative, you know, in the sense of an utterance that enacts what it speaks?
So it's like there are two different issues on the stage, or I guess, as it were. So I think I understand what you were saying about the body, which, you know, kind of fascinates me. And I don't know if you have some thoughts about that, Qiming, but if I'm hearing you correctly, I think you're saying, okay, is there something about moving to China as a kind of representation on the world stage that its kind of status as a body politic that effaces a kind of materialism,
yes,
of the body?
Yes.
I think that's a great question. I don't know if I have an immediate answer to it, but I would say...
It's too big a question for
Well,
tonight,
I mean, I would
maybe.
Say that, you know, there is a fascinating essay by Xu Meishi in the collection, and there she wants to talk about four posts, right? So one of them is post-structuralism, the other is post-humanism, the other is post-socialism, and the other is post-coloniality. Like, those are four different posts that are very, very hard to kind of reconcile with one another. Mm-hmm. And what Xu Meishi says is that you see this dialectic that goes on in the West between post-structuralism and post-humanism, right? Which is that you actually, the West kind of owns post-structuralism, and it's that owning of post-structuralism that allows it to slide right into a kind of post-humanist subject. That movement is not the same as post-socialism or post-coloniality, right? That's a different dialectic that subtends, let's say, Euro-American modernity versus African and Asian modernity. Mm-hmm. And that it's precisely the way in which that first dialectic is privileged that actually brackets or renders that second dialectic, it puts it under the sign of erasure or disappearance. And returning to that would actually get you to a material history that connects, let's say, Asian bodies, African bodies, or even minority bodies in the United States in something that, you know, she calls a Marxist kind of humanism, mm-hmm. right? The problem in China is that Mao really moved us away from the category, right, of the human to the category of the people, because he found it to be such kind of a problematic Western category. But she wants to actually recuperate, right, a kind of Marxist humanism that could connect these different third world movements and connect someone like Fanon to Mao, to Stokely Carmichael, right?
Right.
So I don't know if that really is getting, you know, to your question,
yeah,
but
no, it is.
I do think that, you know, in her reading of these different posts, you can see how one could slide out of a material history, like, let's say, of decolonized bodies or decolonizing movements, and get into a kind of more abstract question of representation. And, you know, it's not quite, I think, the issue of mediation that you really focus on, mm-hmm. Qiming, but it's another way in which one could avoid the movement immediately to, like, representation as an abstraction.
Yeah. No, I think that's very... Qiming?
Oh, I guess I would respond to that a little bit differently, to sort of also remind us of the 18th century context of the emergence of capitalism in the West that was tied to a new kind of consumer or commodity culture that absolutely depended on the influx of commodities from China that were precisely objects and not bodies and people, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, at another discussion we had earlier in the week with Candace Chu, Josephine Park was pointing to one of the sort of basic tenets of Orientalism, in which Asian people stand in for aesthetic objects, right? This form of Orientalism that I think is tied to this long history of when there were many things that were coded as Chinese, but there were no actual people who were immigrating. So for, you know, before the 19th century, you have this real imbalance of a massive influx of objects, right, that are Chinese and that are recognized as Chinese, but the labor is completely invisible to this, the actual labor that's manufacturing these goods. And I do think that that legacy, right, of the mass influx, now it's cheap commodities rather than the luxury commodities that really fueled, right, British mercantile expansion and the rise of British Empire, right? But I do think that this legacy is strong in actually having the things stand for the people, yeah. Which is not exactly what you were asking, Homei, but I do think that that's an important part of how China continues to be figured as spectacle, even though there is a lot more focus now on the body, the suffering body, at the end of a place that lacks human rights, right, according to Western, new Western kinds of Orientalist discourse.
That's very helpful, and I have a question that follows up on that, but I think precisely that kind of abstraction that goes on when Chineseness is associated with kitsch ornament or associated with iPhones, that's precisely what I'm talking about, and in this opening ceremony, we don't see bodies and people. We see an abstraction. We see we see a pattern. We see an ornament. We see a mass ornament, so that's a very that in a way the people disappear. The people are missing from this image. Whereas in what we see in some of these performances, in particular the Koh Sulan piece that we were both there, it's the exact opposite. You can't not be present, and you can't not interact. So. That's, in a way, a much more concrete way of getting it.
Well, I mean, another concrete way is you just have this beautiful reading of the the concept of China, right? That China, of course, is not what Chinese people call themselves. They call it Zhongguo, the Middle Kingdom, right? China comes from porcelain, from China, right? So you see just in the very name, right, this encoding of labor and capital or the country and the object. And that's a legacy that I think continues to this day, right? Is about the illegal immigration stuff, right? Around we're not responsible for any belonging. Like the goods move, the capital moves, but the labor and the bodies don't.
Belonging, yeah. No, exactly. And I want to read just one quote from Qiming's book and follow it up with a question for you that's directly on this topic of China versus and Chinaware porcelain. So Qiming writes, imagined as a predictor of financial ruin, China conveyed the precariousness of a system of Western wealth based on importing novel Eastern goods. It also evinces a peculiar temporality. Its appearance suggests imminent fall and shattering, a negative futurity associated with its physical properties of translucence and fragility. And then you go on to talk about how this contrasts with an image of extreme durability. So these two, the fragility and the durability, sort of built in to this Chinese hardiness or indestructibility versus precariousness. Mm-hmm. And of course, I thought instantly of Huang Rui's Daily Attitude, which is on the wall over here, in which he smashes the plates for each year in a sort of repetitious fashion.
Yeah.
Do you have a reading of this piece that would link it to what you wrote about here?
I actually haven't looked at this in its entirety, but I do think that Huang Rui, along with Ai Weiwei, are very interested in working with porcelain and the kind of tradition of porcelain that is such a source of pride, of Chinese pride, because it does mark this moment where the technology itself was so far superior to anything that could possibly be imitated. in Europe, right? That it was this contradiction of a thing that could withstand incredibly high kiln oven firing temperatures, right? So therefore the durability and all of this transport across thousands of miles, but that could break within a second, right? And so I do think that given Huang Rui's investment in shattering tradition, right, that he works with over and over again in his art, I don't know how much he would intend to be making a comment actually on porcelain. I don't think that that's really what's going on in this piece, you know. But certainly the idea of taking tradition and smashing it or refashioning it is at work. I know that's still pretty vague, you know. But I do think that for me, what's interesting about Chinaware and the name China, right, that's also the name for this exhibit, has to do with that contradiction that's always at work between something that's a thing, something that's a place, right, something that is impenetrable but completely vulnerable at the same time. And it's the flipping between these extremes that I find so bizarrely persists, you know, even in something like this opening ceremonies to the Olympics, right? If you listen to the TV commentary on this, it was always, you know, how can China be so hyper-modern in that it can have the world's largest LED, you know, display on the ground, and yet so hyper-ancient given the 5,000 years, right? And people were remarking on that over and over again, that it was this crazy kind of futurity-antiquity clashing that you get in film, you know, again, that's sort of marrying this idea of new technologies matched with sort of ancient martial arts, you know, that seems to be repeating, you know, again and again as a source of, I think, both fascination but also contradiction. And that's what makes some of this work, I think, really unsettling and radical, is that it's the tradition that's being used to innovate and actually protest against the state, and especially against the state's demolition of standing structures, you know.
But even, you know, in this piece, I did look at it yesterday at the end. It's not that far removed from the stuff that you were talking about in terms of the I Ching project. Because what happens at the end is all of the people who are watching, they go and they take a fragment of the plate as a souvenir. At like the umbrellas, right? And they go off. So there's still a kind of interrelationality that is created in what I think is, you know, much more overt piece about the shattering of tradition as opposed to, you know, kind of a resignifying of it or taking it up.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me, because during the performance piece with the umbrellas, you know, it was a very weird experience for me, because I found that I ended up becoming a kind of de facto translator figure, right? So I don't know if you found this to be the case for me. So people would come up to me and ask what was going on. And I found myself needing to somehow try to draw people in and sort of pitch the piece. So I didn't quite know how to do this. So the thing I would say was, you know, come participate in something and you get a free umbrella. But you have to commit to staying here for 64 minutes. And, you know, you could see just, you know, the range of people coming out of the movie theater, fresh grocer, being like, I don't know if I want to participate. I do want the free thing, but I don't think I can stay for that long. You know, and it was this really weird combination, right, of selling the thing, which I think he's playing with. And because there are things you can take away and take home and carry around with you, that engagement with the commodity, which, you know, he'll say these umbrellas, they were handmade, you know, there's 64 of them, so they're very special. I don't know how handmade these are. I don't know that this is being sewn by.
No, everything is handmade. You know? That's the thing, like, that we all believe, you know, it's everything's mass manufactured.
To the extent
but
that
everything
it
is handmade by China. Apple
it.
Computers,
yeah,
the 64
course.
Components are hand assembled.
Yeah.
You know, there are entire towns in China that make gloves. There are entire towns that make umbrellas. So, yeah, they're handmade.
Yeah, of course. But I think machines participated heavily in the making of that umbrella as opposed to certain other umbrellas. But, no, it was I also saw people doing that calculation, and I do think, I mean, he's very funny, right? This character he's playing is, I think, in one sense, a real healer kind of character, but also a send-up of that image. And I think he's also playing precisely as you said on people's expectations about what they can take away and what they can't. And anyway, it's been about an hour, so I'm wondering if we should see if there are any questions from the group. All right, thank you, David. Thank you, Qiming, so much.
Thank you,
Homei. Don't forget to buy a copy of Performing China.